You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Frame. Mother's Day is almost here. What are you getting her? Something that shows you care. Something that makes her feel loved. Something that won't stress you out. Something like the Skylight Frame. The Skylight Frame is the perfect gift. It's a touchscreen photo frame your whole family can upload photos to, from wherever they are in the world. It's a way to share with her all the moments that matter. It sets up in seconds. You can even make sure that it's already loaded with photos when your mom opens her Mother's Day gift. And her Skylight Frame can hold thousands of the treasured photos you share. It's an easy, heartfelt way for mom to stay connected with those who matter most. It really is the perfect gift. Now, as a special Mother's Day offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com/easy. That's SKYLIGHTFRAME.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightframe.com/easy.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Mama's Talkin' Loud. I'm Jessica Rush.
And I'm Kara Cooper. Today's guest is an Emmy Award-winning journalist, radio host, podcaster, writer, and actress. We are pretty sure there is nothing she can't do.
She joins us today amidst the run of her off-Broadway one-woman show, Approval Junkie, based on her memoir of the same name, to share how it's never too late to find your purpose. Here's our conversation with Faith Saley.
Faith, welcome. We are so happy that you are here.
Good morning.
I am so happy, and I have to stop myself from fangirling. I mean, you know, I'm like the biggest Jazz Hands Broadway fan. So the fact that I get to talk to both of you is so exciting to me. So thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us, for being here. We're super excited. I watch you on CBS Sunday Morning and listen to you on NPR or any number of the many things that you do.
And we might end up walking by each other on the street, Jessica.
Yes.
We're in the hood. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, when we start out, you, as you know, because you've listened, we always ask about your kids, for you to tell us about your kids, because in our world, we don't often get asked that. So will you please share with us about your children?
Yeah, they are preposterously big now. This happens, doesn't it? They grow up, they get breakthroughs and things. My son, Augustus, I'm glad you asked, because I just realized next week is his half birthday. Mm. And we do half birthdays in our house. I usually make a Coca-Cola cake and cut it in half, which is easy to do because it's a bundt. You can cut a bundt in half easily. You have a look of recognition, Jessica. Is this because you grew up in Texas? You know Coca-Cola cake?
Yes.
Yeah. I was like, what is a Coca-Cola cake?
Kara.
I mean, it is some buttermilk, marshmallow, Coca-Cola chocolate goodness. Yeah. And if you're uncomfortable with the word moist, you just don't want to go near this cake. Some people don't like that word. I like that word.
That is true.
I'm going to make you one. Seriously. There will be somehow.
I want to try it.
Delivered to you.
All right.
I grew up in Atlanta. So that is why that enters my life. So my son turns 9 and a half next week. And my daughter would tell you that she is not seven. She's 7 and a half. My son is Augustus. Right. And my daughter is Minerva. And in my show, Approval Junkie, I actually have a little line saying why we named our daughter Minerva.
Buy your tickets and go find out.
So you have to come and see it. Exactly.
I didn't mean to make that such a spoiler. It's My husband is a ancient Greek and Latin scholar, not professionally, but you know, academically, and we were praying for her. He's Jewish. I was raised Catholic, but we light candles anywhere we go. And I was praying for her when I was like 10 weeks pregnant and found out I was having a girl. And we were in Santa Maria Sopra Minerva in Rome, and in Piazza della Minerva, and we thought it's a beautiful name. She's the Roman equivalent of Athena, so the goddess of arts and wisdom.
Well, I think that's perfect.
That's like I feel like that's like the meeting of your minds, right? You're like this artist, this actress, but you're a scholar and a journalist and, you know, a finder of facts. So that's all those things meshed together.
And, you know, my husband is a chief strategy officer. Whatever that means.
Yeah. Yeah. You're talking to two actors here.
Same CSO, but the goddess Minerva / Athena is also the goddess of war and strategy. So it covers all the bases.
It's fascinating. I love it. I love it. I love hearing origin stories of how names come to be and how we as parents choose, you know, these monikers for our kiddos.
You know, it's really meaningful. And my kids have a hyphenated last name, which is my last name first. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. So that if there's ever a prescription and they can't fit the whole name, my kids have my last name on the bottle.
Well done.
Smart. And, I like that.
Yeah. And that's like I suspect you as well are raising very progressive feminist children. But I love that, you know, my kids' names precede them when it comes to how kind of equitable and feminist our family is.
I think that's awesome. You know, I think the same, it's very similar with Elliot being a girl, you know, and as opposed to her, you know, her name is such a sort of gender neutral name now and didn't used to be, but naming her Elliot, it always, whenever people say, just yesterday, I met a stagehand and his name's Elliot. And I said, that's my daughter's name. And he was like, oh, you know, he said, I've never met a girl named Elliot. I mean, he's an older man. And I said, yeah, that's, and he's like, I like that. I like it. And it's always lovely to sort of have that. People are always like, that's really, yeah, I like that. That's cool.
It keeps people on their toes. Like I feel like every time you can sort of subvert gender stereotypes. And I just went out, I took my stage management team out for some drinks last night. And I told them, and y'all must be used to this when being in the theater more often than I am. But at our first rehearsal, everybody went around and said their pronouns. And look, pronouns aren't new to me. Plenty of people have them in their signatures. But in my daily professional life, like we don't express our pronouns explicitly, right? Maybe it's because I've worked with people at Sunday Morning for a dozen years, and same with NPR. I know people's pronouns. Mm-hmm. But it was so wonderful. It was so caretaking because there were plenty of people on our whole Approval Junkie crew and team who are non-binary. And grandma here was like, wait a minute, you can have a she and they pronoun? Explain that to me.
Right? Yeah. Well, that's new in our world too, though. We didn't used to do, I mean, that's all just sort of, and that's what's happened with the movement and with people just sort of waking up and being more aware of the diversity within ourselves. Because in 2019, when we started Tina, we did go around and say our pronouns. That was the very first time I ever did that. So it's not, we haven't been doing it for a long time. It's new to us too.
And there seems like, you know, I just finished hosting this podcast for Audible Originals called Broadway Revival about what happened during the shutdown for so many artists and people in theater and what it's like to return. And so many people talked about the I don't know if this is your experience, the gentleness of returning. Mm. Like not just inclusive, like, hey, what are your pronouns, but how are you feeling? Does your body feel safe going to and from the theater? Our tech rehearsals were not a 10 out of 12. I was there for 8 hours. Yeah. My director was like, no, I'm not going to work you harder than that. Mm-hmm. That makes no sense. Mm-hmm. Just a real sense of like global self-care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a big shift. And I think the people who have been in the industry for a really long time are like, this is really different. Like, it does feel different. And then for the younger people, they're like, no, this is the way it always should be. You know what I mean? There's, I think the next generation has such a different viewpoint on how to move through the world. Whereas those of us who are a little bit older have been like, no, just nose to the grindstone, put your head down. Things
walk uphill both ways in the snow.
Yeah, exactly. Like, things are happening around us that aren't okay, but just keep going. Just keep going. Whereas these younger people are like, no, no, that's not okay. You had a really interesting journey to motherhood. And we want to touch on it just a little bit. You did a segment on CBS Sunday Morning about it. But we've only spoken to one other person that did this, that froze their eggs. So can you tell us a little bit about all of that?
I'm evangelical about it. I feel like that will be, I don't even know if my daughter will have a bat mitzvah, but I'll be like, congratulations, here's a certificate to freeze your eggs when you're 18. I feel like it is the key to any young woman's happiness and liberation, even if you don't know if you ever want to have kids. So I decided, I was married, way too young at age 34. And I think anyone who gets married before 40 or has kids before 40 is just a baby having babies. Because I didn't have my kids till I was 41 or 43, that's all I know. Mm-hmm. And they came exactly when they should have for the kind of parent I want to be and the life experiences I can bring to them. And the gratitude, right? Like, not just in being able to have them in my 40s, but being able to have them with this man, with my husband, and not my husband, which is what I call my first husband. and God bless him. And like, you know, all of that challenging journey with that marriage made me grateful for what I have now. But I was going through my divorce and I was 39 and I was seeing a fertility doctor because I was like, I'm doing this. I don't know how. I'm done waiting for somebody else. I had a plan to move to DC to live in the lower part of my brother and his husband's townhouse. I was like, this is going to happen somehow. I can commute to work. And my fertility doctor, who at that point had done a surgery on me when I was 38, she did all these tests like, why haven't you been pregnant ever? And like, let's rearrange your uterus. Mm-hmm. So she did a surgery on me and my brother David is the one who took care of me. I mean, I don't have a mom. I don't have a sister. I didn't have a husband. My brother David came up from DC and took care of me and bought me the granny panties to wear after surgery. And then he took me downtown to Macy's to sit on Santa's lap and ask for a baby. Which it works, by the way. If you need to believe in Santa, it works. So the same doctor who is like half scientist, half fairy godmother, Dr. Maureen Mumji, she was like, have you ever thought of freezing your eggs? And I just thought that ship had sailed. Like, I thought I was old at 39. And by the way, now that I'm 50, I'm like amazed at how young I am. Right. And so I was 39. And when she said that was an option, I was like, let's do it tomorrow. And the kind of shift in, so I was dating a lot, like not seriously, but I was on this plan to become a single mother by choice, dating a lot. And then I truly think that when I decided to freeze my eggs and kind of become that self-possessed and take control of my future in that way, everything shifted in the universe because my first date with my husband was the night before I started the egg freezing process. And like, he texted me on a BlackBerry, hello, 2010, the morning after our first date. And he was like, hey, what are you doing today? And I was like, I'm just going to tell him. I had my BlackBerry under the table at the NYU fertility orientation. And I was like, I'm at a orientation for freezing my eggs. And this was back before there were appropriate emojis to respond to someone you just started dating who told you she's freezing her eggs. So he just did one of those, like, you know, whatever you use on the keyboard to do an open mouth.
Yeah.
Right. Like, slash.
And like, other than that, he was unflinching. And we, our courtship was like timed around shots and, you know, pelvic rest. And when we got married merely a year later, because that's what happens when you date, when two people are 39 and you meet each other and you're like, this is it, we're doing it. I told him in my wedding vows, I knew you were the one when you let me put my syringe in your refrigerator. and it's true. Like, what kind of guy is just totally okay with that? But what's really interesting is that our son Augustus was conceived naturally. After 11 months after we started dating, I got pregnant naturally. As my friend Danny, I was shooting a pilot while I was dating John, and my friend Danny, the producer, knew that I was dating a man who was a member of the tribe, and announced to the cast and crew that I was engaged in the Jewish Semen Acquisition Project, or JSAP. And he would yell during the shoot, JSAP, ASAP. So apparently JSAP worked, and as I say in my show, Jewish semen is magic. And I got pregnant, like John and I got pregnant. Well, I got pregnant. He helped. I had a miscarriage. Mm. Then I tried, this is all when we were just dating. 2 weeks after my miscarriage, he proposed to me. And then that summer, we have 3 months to plan a wedding in Rome. We try some artificial insemination, because why not? So that didn't work. Then I had a chemical pregnancy, which you may or may not be. Mm-hmm. That's sort of like, they say you can't be sort of pregnant. Well, you can.
Yeah.
And then as we are going to Rome to get married, I find out I'm pregnant again naturally. And my fertility doctor is like, look, I need you to have low expectations. Like, you might have a miscarriage on your honeymoon, and that's okay, because we have IVF planned for when you get back. And I didn't have a miscarriage on my honeymoon. And we went to Vespers all over Italy. And when we came back, we saw a heartbeat on the ultrasound. And I had my son at 41, and then went back to the frozen eggs to get my money's worth, did IVF, had a miscarriage. And then Minerva is my lab baby. As we like to call her. She was the product of one of my 18 frozen eggs.
Wow.
Sorry, you thought that would be a short story.
No. Wait, I love it. And I love that you – go ahead.
I was pregnant 5 times in 3 years. And there was never – as devastated as I was by the miscarriages, I have to say I had so much faith in both faith and God and the universe and in science. And I never thought I wasn't going to become the mother that I wanted to be. And maybe that was naive, but I'm so lucky.
I mean, it's an incredible story, an incredible journey. And even in your retelling of it, you can hear that you never lost your faith. Like, you can hear that even though there were these bumps along the road, you knew it was going to happen. And going back to the beginning of how you opened it, this thought that freezing our eggs, it's like the ultimate feminist movement we could do, because it takes away this thing that makes us unequal, or in society's eyes, unequal to the men in society. And it takes away that pressure to find a husband or find a partner or figure out how you're going to have kids before you're old and, you know, unable. I mean, I just think that's such a...
That's exactly right. It takes away the urgency.
Yeah. And it allows you to pursue an incredible career like you have pursued. And that's something that we talk about so much in our industry as women and as people that our youth is of the utmost importance in our industry. Unfortunately, that's just the way it is. And it's a fact. And that dividing line before motherhood and after motherhood is a defining line in our industry. And to take away kind of that pressure of it, and to be able to do it later in life, and to also take away the need to balance a career and also this heavy, like the most important thing we can do in this world, right? Is procreate and bring forth the next generation and raise the next generation. Like to divide and conquer. It's just such a what is the word I'm looking for? Not rational, but it's just so, oh my gosh, my brain is not working. That's motherhood for you right there. I'll tell you what, that's what that is in this moment.
I would add that, yes, I mean, by the way, if you hear a siren, that's because, yes, I do live in New York. Yes. So just if you're listening, this is real. It's not sound effects we add in. Should I pause?
No, it's all right.
No? Okay, wow. Keep it really real.
We do.
You know, something you just said, Kara, was that like the most important thing we do is become parents. And yes, and in the spirit of improv, I am also so unbelievably fulfilled by the work I do, that creativity, that kind of productiveness, that they're not even mutually exclusive. Like no one's making me choose between being all that I am professionally and being a mother. And what I think freezing one's egg and sort of harnessing all the control you can about your own fertility proactively, it allows you to do both. And no one should make apologies for that. No one should have to set her dreams aside while focusing on becoming a mother.
I agree completely. And I figured out the word practical.
Practical.
It's so practical. The practicality.
Exactly. And yes, let's also, while we're using the P word practical, it's also, I am also privileged that I could afford it. So let me put that out there. Like that was like, I was 39. I wasn't paying for braces or school or clothes. I was like, what I'm going to spend my money on right now is freezing my eggs. But I will also say, and I guess I'm just unbelievably lucky and anomalous, but my whole like professional ascendancy happened in my 40s after spending ages 25 to about 36 in LA, feeling like I was too old already. I had grown up doing theater. I had done musical theater professionally as a kid, and then in college, and then in grad school. I was in England for grad school. And then I'm like a doofus. I moved to LA being like, let's go do sitcoms when what I should have done is gone to New York. But the universe got me back to New York anyway, in a really itinerant way. But I spent a decade trying to sell myself in LA, trying to be the funniest, prettiest, skinniest, whateverest. And I distinctly remember an acting class I was in when I was 34. And the teacher was like, you know, you're too old, right? And it was, and I believed it. I internalized it. So the fact that I had my kids in my 40s, that I got on CBS Sunday Morning and NPR in my 40s, that I wrote a book in my 40s, that in my 40s, I was asked to turn my book into a play. And my husband pulled me aside the other day and he was like, baby, you're 50 and you're starring in an off-Broadway show in which you play yourself. Because my joke is like, during the pandemic, I was like, when the show comes back, I hope I'm not too old to play myself. And he was like, that doesn't often happen. And so I don't want any of us, by the way, looking at you two, you both look like, for whatever it's worth, because looks don't matter, but you're both gorgeous, look like you're 25. Like, I don't want us women to keep like articulating the idea that age matters so much. Maybe it does, but I almost like, I don't want my daughter to ever hear me say that. Like, no. For me, I just put blinders on. Age didn't matter for when I became a mother. It didn't matter for when I wrote my book. It doesn't matter for when I finally get to perform off Broadway. And I just want to hope that that kind of improbable momentum continues for me.
Hear, hear. That's so true.
You're
it's
giving
so
me hope,
good.
Faith.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
Exactly. My husband keeps saying, like,
the best is yet to come.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is. Y'all are so young. When I listened to your podcast, Jessica, you were just talking about being 40 the other day. And I was like, at 40, I wasn't even married or had a baby.
True.
You're so young.
When you're surrounded by actual young people, though, 8 times a week, quite so young.
Okay, that's fair, because I am only surrounded by our 24-year-old nanny.
Right,
every
exactly.
Once in a while, I'm like, damn, I'm as old as her mother.
When you work with people who are like, I was born in 1997, and you're like, or we have someone who was born in 1999.
Yeah, one of my stage managers was
born in the
year 2000.
It's born in the 2000s. Yeah, yeah. I mean, okay, that takes it into a whole different. but you are giving, like, to hear that you have accomplished all those things post 40 is really exciting, honestly. Like, coming from a very heartfelt position of someone who's kind of trying to figure out what, like, the next phase of my career slash life, what I want it to look like, that's really exciting to me, to think that other things can happen besides this thing, this pocket of my life that has been just one thing, you know?
I'm so glad it's exciting. It should be, because other things can and will happen, 100%.
We're going to take a quick break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Well, you gave us the perfect segue to Approval Junkie. I want you to talk us through it all, like the inception of
sure?
the book.
You're giving me a lot of time. Doing too much talking. I feel very uncomfortable because I'm used to interviewing people, and I'm like, I want to stop and listen to you.
Yeah. No, we like the
You're
talk
way more page. Interesting. Trust.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I think I want to know about how it started. Obviously, how it evolved into a one-woman show. But I think, like, and correct me if I'm wrong, we all have. You're either an approval junkie or you're not. Like, my friend has a daughter who could give two F's about what anybody else thinks. And she's always so worried about her. And I'm like, she's going to be the happiest person in the world. Like, she's just going to move through life, like, doing what serves her. And, you know, maybe to detriment of others, that's yet to be determined. However, you know, I think that we have this thing in us that you're an approval junkie or you're not. You may think differently. But also, the industry that we all are in, right? Oh, you said you went to LA and you were there for 10 years. Like, being an actress is all about gaining somebody else's approval so you can get a job.
That's
like,
exactly
it's
right.
Literally
you
what
be picked.
You need to do.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's my little tidbit, but talk us through the inception of the book and how it then became this one woman show you're doing right now.
I was getting my headshots taken when I was probably 27, and the makeup artist was named Teo. That would be T-H-E-O, but pronounced Teo. Okay. And he just P.S. like read my tarot cards while he was doing my makeup and was like, wait a minute.
You were so in L.A.
Oh, please. There's a whole part in my show about how I went to the acting guru in LA. Her name is Leslie Kahn. She is still out there. Her acting studio, locals call it the Constitute. And I read my lines with her because she was like coaching me for an audition. And she looks at me so intently that I was like, oh my God, she's about to say, I don't know why you're not a massive star. And instead she looks at me and she says, why aren't you as pretty as I want you to be? So that is the like apex of an LA story. Well, let me add that my husband was then producing a TV show and he created a role for me and I didn't get it.
No,
so I like the role was the character was named Hope. Like it was made absolutely for me and I didn't get my own role on the show my husband was producing because probably I wasn't pretty enough. But anyway, I was just throwing that in for how LA it all was. And Teo looked at me and he was like, wait a minute, you're a writer. I was like, I mean, I'm an actor. Like, my friends are writers. I had so many friends from college who like were writing sitcoms at the time. Like, I had, and I had my master's in literature. So my idea of writing was like, well, Virginia Woolf's a writer. Dickens is, the Brontes are writers. And it took me, you know, 15 years to accept the fact that I am, among other things, am a writer. And I got to my early 40s and was so astonished at the happy endings that I had been given to me, and I had in some way achieved, also being very lucky. You know, I finally found my beshert, as they say. I mean, I am married to a Jewish man, and I'm not Jewish, but I love dropping in the Hebrew and the Jewish. Roll with me. And that I would finally figured out my fertility piece. I had come to peace with the loss of my mother, which pulled the rug out from under me when I was 26 years old, just surviving Hollywood, all the things. And I thought, okay, I want to write. I want to share my experiences. And I have so many different stories. Under what theme can I share them? Like, they have to be organized. I'm not Tina Fey. Tina Fey can just write stories about her life because she's Tina Fey, right? right. But I need some kind of organizational idea. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm an approval junkie. Like, I have, these are the things, the beautiful, pathetic, amazing things, embarrassing things I have done in the name of being heard and being seen and being loved. And I thought, you know, for a certain type of very honest human being, that will be resonant. Mm. So the book comes out in 2016. And on my mother's birthday, which is August 29th, I receive an email in 2016 from Susan Booth. Does that name ring a bell to either of you? Mm. She is the artistic director of the Alliance Theater in Atlanta. Oh. Mm. And she and I have never met. And she sends an email saying, this may be crazy, but I read your book. And would you consider turning it into a one-woman show for our 50th anniversary at the Alliance Theater?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Talk about fairy godmother.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what Susan didn't know was that, I mean, she read my book, so she knew I grew up in Atlanta. But what she didn't know was, like, the Alliance Theater was Broadway to me. Mm-hmm. Twice a year, mm-hmm. I got to stay mm-hmm. up late and dress up. And my parents put me in the back of whatever gigantic 80s car they were driving at that point. And we got to go to the Alliance Theater. And I got to see a musical. And I got to see, usually they took me to one Shakespeare. And the productions there are exquisite. It's, like, one of the best regional theaters in the country. And that's where I sat as, like, 8-year-old Faith, saying, like, oh, I want to do that. That's what I want to do. Mm. And for her to invite me to come back to the place where it all began, like in my heart, to play myself after years of trying to get someone to pick me to play somebody else was just, and again, like, y'all, my whole story is about striving. And this, like, this one thing was given to me. Yeah. I didn't have to, like, knock on a door and say, I just turned my book into a script. So that's how it began. And I still can't believe it. Like, who's this lucky?
That's amazing. Knock on the wood. No, yeah. That's incredible. I mean, we both know what that's like to search for approval and search for approval and audition and audition and audition and try to make yourself into something. Maybe you're not, just figuring out, what do they want me to be? What should I be? All these things. And for someone to see you through your memoir, to read the book and have such a reaction and a visceral response to want to extend that to you, to say, come be yourself and do this.
And to have the faith in me that I would know how to turn a book into a play.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
She really laid it out on you, Faith.
Yeah. I am forever indebted to Susan Booth, who is just a great human being in every way. And it's interesting because in my book, my gay best friend, Manfred, introduced me. He and John's gay best friend, Rob, and my gay best friend, Manfred, are the ones who introduced us to each other. So we say we were set up by Gay Date. Uh-huh. And it turns out that Susan and Manfred had gone to grad school together for directing. And they and their professor, and I put this in my book, their professor taught them to think of living, hold on, I want to get this right, nakedly human publicly. And the first time I met Susan in person, because she was up in New York and we went out to dinner after I had said, I mean, I was not coy. I emailed her right back and was like, are you kidding? Yes, I'll do this. I don't know how. I'll need help. But yes. But we went out to dinner and she like dropped the fact that, and Manfred, by the way, it's like my kid's godparents, right? Was our best man. And she's like, I went to school with Manfred and this is what our professor taught us. And that's what I try to do. And you know, there's a cost of it. There are, when you play yourself or when you are a commentator like I am, or when you express your opinion and when you are a woman and when people don't like the sound of your voice or how big your forehead is, you you live nakedly human publicly, like there are people who are not going to like you and it will live forever on social media. And yet, like, I'm not saying I'm brave because I'm not, I just don't know any other way to be.
Same.
Right?
Same. No, I that's what, yeah. I've said that before, I think. Yeah, Kara knows. I have no filter, but I don't know. And also at this age, I have zero X left to give. You know what I mean? Yep. Like, it's not worth it. But I don't know how to not be an open book. So I get that. I identify with that.
So it's interesting you say that, because do people often say to you, like, this would come from people presumably who would not enjoy performing. So people often say to me, especially with a one woman show, right? 90 minutes, no intermission, about my life, right? They're like, oh my God, you're so brave. And it's such a generous compliment, but I always say, thank you. And it does, if that's not what it's about, I think that doesn't suit, right? Like, it might be brave for them to go up on stage because that's not how they're built, but I just feel lucky. Like, no, I want to say, you are so generous. You put on pants. You decided not to watch Netflix. You showed up to hear my stories and sat there in a mask and opened your heart to receive my stories.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah, it's true.
I mean, do you think you're brave? I guess we're all a little brave to go into this business, but it's not what I lead with. It sounds like patting yourself on the back for being so heroic.
No, I don't think I'm brave. I mean, I definitely, doesn't mean I don't have massive anxiety or agita when I speak about some things that I know are going to not be handled well, but I don't think of myself as being brave. I just don't know any other way to be. I talk a lot, so... Kara shared a dressing room with me for 6 years. She knows this. It's like, you know, I do.
Yeah. And I'm on the other end of the spectrum. Like, I'm definitely open, but I'm definitely not, let me just tell you everything about me. Do you know what I mean? At the drop of a hat. I'm a little more
reserved,
I think.
Guarded.
Well, then you get extra credit for doing this podcast.
Thanks.
Because you are
I've shared more on this podcast, I think, than I ever thought. Well, you were talking about brave. It's like how we talk to our son about being brave. We were talking about the word and we were like, being brave is doing something that scares you. If it doesn't scare you, it's not being brave, you know, because it's just something that you're going to do. And we're like, no, bravery is when it's something that is hard for you or scary and you do it anyway, you know?
That's exactly right. And I try to let my kids know through this very abbreviated rehearsal process. We had 3 weeks of rehearsal and then only a 4 week run. For now,
I'm gonna knock wood again. Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I would love to do the show in LA. I feel like it would strike a different chord there. Yeah.
I'm sure.
But I wanted my kids to know, even though I didn't see them much during the rehearsal process, I wanted them to know how yucky and hard and excruciating it is, how vulnerable it is. Again, not making myself feel like a hero, but they'll be like, hi mama, how was rehearsal? And I'd be like, I don't feel like I did very well today, but I like, it's hard. Like my director, Amanda Watkins, who, by the way, I should completely credit with turning my book into a play because she had the vision that I didn't. With a lot of post-it notes, it was like a beautiful mind, the post-it notes everywhere, figuring it out. But she loves sitting in the muck of creativity, where you don't know the answers. And as the writer and performer, It's hard. It's hard to rehearse in a room where there's no spotlight, there's no filter. You just have the stage manager and the COVID supervisor and your director sitting there, and they've heard all your jokes a million times, and you're still trying to figure out your lines and your blocking. It's so naked. And there were, I don't use the word sucked in front of my kids, but there were so many times I sucked. And I wanted them to know that, right? That's, I think that's part of the being brave, is like being so nervous and but still being willing to make mistakes. It's Rosie Revere Engineer. Y'all have that book, right?
Yes. Yes.
Kara, do you have that book?
Yes.
Okay, just checking. I was gonna like I was gonna send it to you Prime this afternoon.
We got it. Don't worry.
Okay. Phew.
So I feel like there's this intersection, and correct me if this hasn't been your experience, but becoming a mother, right, is for me, I think, shifted the who I saw approval from.
Yes.
It wasn't necessarily from my kids, but like approval of myself. Like, it's a constant battle to be like, oh, am I doing this right? Am I doing this wrong? What am I doing? So it's less about the exterior, although that certainly has an effect, especially in the age of social media and the images we see of motherhood. We're constantly bombarded with this image of perfection. But for me, it's been much less about that, but more about, oh my gosh, am I doing a good enough job? So it's been seeking approval for myself on motherhood. How has that been for you? You have a great quote in your book about, I'm going to try to quote you right now. If you seek approval from someone who thinks it's hilarious to do downward dog in a diaper while he farts, you are an approval masochist. So I assume you were talking about Augustus there, but talk a little bit about your need for approval and how it shifted during motherhood.
Oh, it's such a time capsule when I wrote the book, because yes, my son was barely two and my daughter was a newborn.
Oh my God.
I was breastfeeding her with one arm and typing with the other hand. By the way, I loved your interview with Elizabeth Stanley talking about all the different places one can breastfeed. I breastfed in a corner of the CDC. Well, I mean, not breastfed. I'm sorry. I pumped in a corner of the CDC. I pumped in waders, Waders, when I was like doing a story on oysters. I was like in Cape Cod on an oyster farm, like with the breast pump, just all over the place. I agree with you. There is nothing like motherhood to clarify what's important to you. And by the way, I want to be really conscious about this. I would like to say parenthood. Being a parent is as important to my husband as it is to me. I know that's not always the case. And I think that's really sad. And I hope it's usually the case, frankly, right? My husband and I talk a lot about the parents we want to be. We have a FaceTime session with an incredible family psychologist who is our parenting coach. And we've been seeing her for an hour a week for the past 3 years. And it's kind of instead of couples therapy, because we're both there together. And frankly, if we ever have tensions, it's usually around who's doing what and how much are you doing. And and a friend of mine, she put it so beautifully. It's not about the kind of people you want your children to end up being. It's about the kind of parent you want to be to them, right? We have very little control over who our kids become, really. We can role model generosity, gratitude, silliness, purpose. We can role model all those things. But at least my husband and I are not the kind of people who are going to say our child's going to be a chess master, or our child's going to speak five languages. I think we missed the boat on that. and every time I come back to what centers me is thinking, was I the kind of parent I wanted to be today? And by the way, to your question, Kara, that is how I give myself approval. And I can tell you, again, I'm not a superhero, but most days I am the kind of parent I want to be. It's not easy. It takes preternatural amounts of patience. But part of being the parent I want to be, and I think this is, I want everyone to hear this. This is my absolute favorite quotation about parenthood. It's from Jung, Carl Jung. The greatest burden on a child is the unlived life of its parents. Note the pronoun. It's so weird that Carl Jung said its parents. Okay. But anyway, I don't know if he was a great dad. It sounds like Gollum. Precious. So maybe you've covered that on the show before. But I am the best mother I can be when my children witness me showing up for them and living my life. My children have, okay, fine, for 4 weeks, I don't get to put them to bed. They get to see their mother walk out the door to do her own Broadway show. Sorry, wishful thinking. Off-Broadway. You're the ones on Broadway.
Speak it. Hey, speak put it in the babe. Universe. Put, speak it.
I love it. But like, I just posted a picture of my son walking by a kiosk, just casually walking down New York City Street on the Upper East Side. And there's his mom on a kiosk. And I don't mean to be self-aggrandizing. What I'm saying is like, holy, I won't say a bad word because of your mom, Jessica. Holy crap. My children are witnessing their mother at age 50 have her dreams come true. Like, isn't that something to give them and show them?
Absolutely. And it's something to show fellow mothers and fellow people, and just, you know, to show people that you never have to stop dreaming. I think it's so hard, like we've talked about, after a certain age in this business. I know Kara and I are both struggling. Even though I'm working, I still am like, wait, but what's next? And who am I? And I'm over 40 now, and I'm not the chorus girl. And what's, you know, but I don't have the Tony nomination. I mean, it's all these things. And to just hear something like that, where at the age of 50, you have accomplished all these things in the span of like a decade, and this ultimate dream of yours that you didn't even know you had, right? Like, this was not something you even knew you had, and it came and came to you. And it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. I love that.
It really is.
Who asked me this? Oh, I was doing a little publicity thing and for Audible, and they said, whom would you like to be at opening night? And I said, my daughter, who can't see the show because there are a few F words. Mm-hmm. And Ruth, who is my 105-year-old friend, whom I talk about in my prologue.
Well, and I saw Ruth going to vote on Twitter back when you took her.
And that's the first line. So when we returned to the show, we added a prologue, and that's the first line of the show. I say, in October of 2020, I took my 104-year-old friend Ruth to vote, and my daughter Minerva held her hand as she did that. And let's remember that, like, when Ruth was born, women couldn't vote. But the third person I said is, I wish my mom could be there. And I just brought that up, Jessica, because of the way you just said that, like how beautiful it is to have this come true. And my mom died when she was 2 years older than I am now. And I talk about her in the show. She's infused throughout the show. But it's an amazing thing to reach what I hope is the middle of my life. And her prayer for me was, She wrote me a card a week since I left for college until she went into hospice. And she always signed off. She'd say, I pray for your peace, purpose, and happiness. And those are the last lines of the show that I say to my daughter. And that word purpose, I don't think I understood it when she was writing me in my early 20s. Now I get it. Like, that's... Mm-hmm. Purpose transcends approval, right? When you're in your purpose, there's no need for any external validation. And you're pumped with your own internal validation because life is clarified.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was...
I can't help but thinking in the telling of how this show came to be, that your mom had a hand in it. I mean, that it was on her birthday that you got that email that it was at the Alliance Theater where she used to take you. I mean, and in all, you know, obviously our industry lost a great contributor this past week, but everybody's talking about how he can now be at every performance, right? So your mom's there. Oh. There's no way she's not, you know? She's with you. Yeah. I mean, it's funny that you didn't get the part of Hope in the show your husband wrote or was mm-hmm. producing, because I feel like that's all you have given me in this past hour that we've been speaking to you is hope. You know, hope to move forward and faith to know that like things can continue and the pursuit of your dreams and our happiness is what's the most important, and getting that purpose so we can show our kids that every day. So thank you, Faith, so much for being here and for talking to us and for sharing your truth. And you guys, if you want to hear more of Faith's story, you have to check out Approval Junkie. This comes out on Tuesday, so there'll probably be 2 weeks left of performance, correct?
Oh, please. Yes, that's right. And also it will be recorded for Audible, so it will be like available to hear as a play in the spring. But please come if you can. Come and sit in the theater and hear me talk to Ruth and my mom and my daughter.
Yes,
for sure.
I can't imagine they won't want to be flocking after hearing you just speak a little bit about it, because now I can't wait to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God. You know what? I know somebody. I can get you a seat.
I have to get my babysitter, but I will do it.
I will pay for your babysitter. I would love to have you there.
Amazing. Amazing. Thank you so much, Faith. I hope you have a great Sunday.
I have a matinee to do. Look how I'm so excited.
Look at that.
I know this is old hat to you, Jessica, but I'm like, all right, everybody, I'm going to my matinee.
No, I love it. May we all have that much joy as we head to do our shows today. Do you know what I mean? Like, let's just, that's what it should be. It should be joyful. It should be fun. Yes, it's a job, but it should be joyful. And so I love your enthusiasm and I love it so much. And I'm so happy that we were able to talk to you. So thank
you
so much.
Me too. Thank you. Y'all have Coke cakes coming your way somehow.
Have a good one.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Mama's Talking Loud. Special shout outs to Justin Squiggs Robertson for our fabulous new graphic, Kristen Lopez, Bobby Lopez, and Justin Wardweber for our awesome theme song, and of course, the Broadway Podcast Network for bringing us to you.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.